You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In an example of the crackdown on civil liberties, Peace Watch reporter Eddie Becker was detained by a Federal Bureau of Investigations agent at a recent federal appreciation event on the Mall here in the nation's capital.
I'm Barbara Wallace, and Supervisory Special Agent, Unit Chief for Community Outreach for the FBI.
How has the mission of the FBI changed since the terror attack?
Since 9/11, we are more proactive as opposed to reactive. In other words, now our mission is to reach out and find information to eliminate the possibility of another attack occurring.
How would you go about and do that?
We have what we call Joint Terrorism Task Force, JTTFs, where we have state, local, county, and FBI, as well as other federal agencies that work with us to collect that information.
Okay, let me just interject here while I'm editing this, that I think that it's legit to try to stop terrorists before they blow innocent people up, but without real close monitoring by the legislative and judicial branches of the government, as well as reporters and just plain patriotic folk. I think the authorities, especially the FBI with its legacy of political repression and arbitrary enforcement, will increasingly turn against the people it has sworn to protect. But you say to be the subject of their wrath, you must be doing something illegal, and their illegal operations and abuses are history. Well, all I can say is that when you scratch the surface, that old repressive culture reemerges.
You also still do drug-related intelligence and keep track of subversive organizations and dissidents and the like.
Yes, we have about over 300-plus classifications of violations that we investigate.
The FBI has had a difficult history, especially in the civil rights community or in that community that went through the Vietnam War. Or even among labor unions, the FBI has been seen as representing the interests of people who were trying to stop the change, stop Americans of African descent from gaining full equality.
Being an African-American female, I would disagree with that. I believe that we all in the United States, or anyone who's human, bring certain prejudice to our place of employment, or worship, or where we live, because of just by the mere factor of what we believe and what we think.
Certainly, I'm not talking only about now. I'm talking about what was done to Martin Luther King.
The FBI collected intelligence on people it identified as posing a threat to the United States or critical of the FBI. Sometimes it used that information operationally, either true or fabricated, in an attempt to neutralize people.
You know, there's a lot of rumors, conjecture, misinformation. Have we investigated some things or not done some things as well as we could have? Probably so. But to say that we've had problems and that we could not be trustworthy, I could not agree with that. I can't agree with that.
I mean, audio tape, his most intimate...
Sir, I'm not going to try and defend or try and get into specifics of anything.
I'm just telling you what the record says. I'm not making that up. I mean, that's part of the FBI reading room.
I'm not buying into what you're saying. I'm not going to go there. Not with this interview or any interview.
Okay.
I need for you to write your information down for me so I can pass this on.
I don't know, man. I'm afraid of the FBI. I think they might put me in a database.
No, we won't put you in any database. Let me write down your information. What's your name?
Eddie Becker.
Becker? Okay. And Eddie, it was Pacific what?
Pacifica Radio. What are you going to do with this information?
I work for the FBI, so therefore I have to let them know, because if they hear me on radio, they need to know what I discussed and what I said.
All right, well,
okay.
If they hear you, they'll hear what you said.
I want to make sure, so that's why I want to get your address and telephone number so I can get back in touch with you.
They're not going to erase my hard drive, are they?
You know what, maybe I should take your tape. Maybe, I don't know if you're going to try and misconstrue something that I said.
You want to take my tape? Is that serious?
I said, no, maybe I should take it. I mean, the way you're acting here, I need your telephone number where I can get a hold of you.
I'm afraid now that you're like threatened to take my tape, then...
I didn't threaten to take your tape.
What
I
did
said,
you say?
I said, maybe I should take your tape with the way you're acting. Well, I did not say, I'm going to take your tape.
That is a threat.
Eddie, are you going to give me your telephone number? And then, okay, then I need to call security.
So you are threatening me?
No, I'm not threatening
and
you.
And you will take my tape?
I'm going to wait right here for security with you.
Am I under arrest? And what charge am I being held?
You're going to wait right here with security with me.
So if I give you my number, I can go?
You're going to wait right here for security with me. Simple as that.
And if I leave?
Oh, you're not going to leave.
Why?
Trust me, you're not going to leave.
Will you restrain me?
I'm going to make sure you don't leave.
All right. If I give it to you, will you let me go?
Yes.
All right.
Eddie, who's your supervisor?
Right here.
Vern.
You're not going to make me lose my job, are you?
No, why would I do that?
The FBI eventually released our reporter, Eddie Becker, but then again, he did hand over my name and our phone number here at Pacifica.
Commies, pinkos, rats at the windows, foreign agitators, running elevators, J. Edgar Hoover in a pink tutu. Anyone who thinks like you. Welcome to the 50s, you look a little shifty. They call the FBI. I had to disappear.
Also weighing in on the civil liberties issue is renowned writer, pediatrician, and activist Dr. Helen Caldicott. Speaking recently with KPFK's Stephen Rohde, she discussed why she became an outspoken opponent of nuclear weapons and how she plans to combat the corporate control of the media, which she says prevents information about the threat of nuclear weapons and nuclear waste from getting to the public. An informed citizenry, Caldicott says, is the only way a nation can preserve the civil liberties of its citizens. This is part two of a 10-part series, A Clear and Present Danger, which is a production of Penn USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Dr. Caldicott, for over 30 years, you have been championing the message of the threat of nuclear war, nuclear power. What we're interested in is the kinds of obstacles you've confronted in the media, through corporations, through governments, in getting that message out to the public.
Well, I suppose I should go back to the very beginning when I started talking about the medical dangers of fallout from the French nuclear tests in the atmosphere in the Pacific, and I lived in Adelaide, Australia. Because I knew about the medical effects of radiation and children getting leukemia and cancer, and because I was training as a pediatrician at the Adelaide Children's Hospital, I was deeply concerned about the fallout. So I wrote a letter to the Advertiser, which was the local newspaper, saying children could get leukemia and cancer from these tests because they're very sensitive to radiation, more so than adults. And they didn't publish the letter. I called the editor and I said, where's my letter? And he was very patronizing in an Australian misogynist way. And he said, well, madam, we get hundreds of letters a day. And I said, yes, but mine's important. And I talked him through it. And I suppose he reached into his waste paper basket, unscrewed the letter and published it. So the next day, I was asked to speak on the television show called This Day Tonight, which was the current affairs program. And there was a man called Clive Hale, who was quite patronizing, condescending, and who nailed me to the wall like a butterfly with a pin through its stomach. And because I didn't know everything there was to know about fallout and French tests, any mistake I made, I got castigated. But as in medicine, when you make a mistake with a patient, you never make that mistake again, and that's how you learn medicine or learn anything. So every time I stood up and talked publicly, and if I made a mistake, I would read voraciously that particular part of the subject, and I would be very well informed. And in 9 months, 75% of Australians rose up and said, we won't have the French testing their bloody bombs down here. Now, what happened was I was attacked in the media by the head of nuclear medicine at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, and the headlines were hysterical woman doctor, yak, 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 you know? And I was devastated. But each time I was attacked, I was more determined. So that's been the history, I guess, of my life, overcoming obstacles in the media.
Your latest book is The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. There you're speaking about a collusion between the death merchants, these large corporations that feed on building nuclear weapons and other weapons, and the government, and a combination of politicians and the manipulation of public opinion. What can you tell us essentially about that?
Well, the corporations are the government. Let's be frank. The White House is peopled and populated by the corporations. 32 members of this administration come from the military-industrial complex. I think 22 from Lockheed Martin alone. Many of the others come from the Heritage Foundation, which is paid for by Lockheed Martin and other military-industrial corporations. So this administration is a military-industrial administration. It doesn't represent the people. The corporations, A, own the media, and then other corporations advertise on the media. And the media is all about making money. NBC is owned by GE. GE makes nuclear power plants, nuclear weapons, and missiles. Until recently, CBS was owned by Westinghouse, which makes nuclear power plants, nuclear weapons, and missiles. And then Disney owns ABC. So we've got a major problem here, and it must be solved urgently because the planet's in the intensive care unit, and we're not sure if it's going to survive, but we're all physicians to a dying planet.
A few years ago, in one of the most censored stories in America, the Department of Energy was selling nuclear waste as scrap metal in the United States. Tell us why that was not getting public attention.
I know about that. It's called below regulatory concern. They deregulate a certain level of radioactive waste, and they're actually, as we speak, putting it in knives and forks, braces for teeth, children's teeth, metal plates for hips, jewelry, belt buckles, you name it. I don't know how it got covered up, but I do know the Department of Energy is run by the nuclear industry, and I do know that the Department of Energy actually makes nuclear weapons. That's what they do, but they have to get rid of their radioactive waste, and a great way to do it is to sell it, as you said. So I suppose that's why the story got covered up. I knew about it. It was in the New York Times, but you've got to go to the back page, and you've got to be discriminating about the way you glean your information from the media. It was out there, but it wasn't, you know, top of the news on CBS.
Recently, the Bush administration approved making Yucca Mountain a repository for something like 77,000 tons of high-level nuclear waste. This has been a debate, but I doubt Americans have addressed the risks that are posed by
that. No, but they will. Once they start sending 300 shipments through the highways and byways and railways of this country, through all the towns and cities every year for the next 30 years, and one of those shipments turns over in Chicago and burns, it's a mobile Chernobyl. And people in Chicago will be contaminated with levels of radiation that are very high, some close to the accident, will develop acute radiation sickness. Their hair will fall out within days. They will start vomiting, having bloody diarrhea, and die, like patients with AIDS die. Then 5 years later, there'll be an epidemic of leukemia, particularly amongst the children who are 20 times more radiosensitive than adults. Then there'll be an epidemic of solid cancers 15 years thereafter for the rest of time. That will end the Yucca Mountain mobile Chernobyl proposal, but by then it will be too late. It's absolutely wicked what they're proposing to do, and they're doing it because the nuclear industry wants to continue running nuclear power plants, and their spent fuel pools are full of radioactive fuel, and they don't have anywhere to put the fuel that comes out of the reactor every year, 30 tons of deadly radioactive waste. So in order to continue running and operating their nuclear power plants, they have to empty the fuel pools. So they're going to send it to Yucca Mountain. Now, a scientist at Los Alamos, I think his name was Bowman, a couple of years ago did a study and said, wait a minute, plutonium lasts for 500,000 years. 10 pounds is critical mass. If you get it together, you have a nuclear explosion. He said, as the canisters rust, which they will because there's water in that mountain, eventually 10 pounds of plutonium is going to leak down in the crevice in the rock and blow the top off the mountain and spread the nuclear waste to the four winds. And another scientist said, yeah, we hadn't thought about that. So Abraham, who's the Secretary of Energy, and I doubt if he's scientifically literate, puts a hard hat on, walks into Yucca Mountain, into the caverns they've dug, stays there for about half an hour or an hour, walks out and says, this is a terrific idea, and I approve it. George Bush, who probably doesn't even understand the difference between gamma, beta, alpha, radiation, X-rays and neutrons, says he thinks it's a terrific idea too. The problem is that less than 3% of politicians are scientifically literate, and they're manipulated by the nuclear industry, which is wicked.
Why is this not on the cover of every newspaper, the lead story of every network and cable news network in America?
Look, I think there are several reasons. Nuclear power was sold in the 50s and 60s as Americanism, as patriotism, and I write about this in my book, Nuclear Madness. Why doesn't the New York Times put it on its front? Yes, it does put it on the front pages, you know, by Matthew Wald, who writes good stuff. So that's where I get my data from. Why doesn't Larry King? Well, I suppose he puts a little segment in here and there, but it's not, as you said, front page headlines. Whereas if a little girl gets murdered, and I'm sorry for that little girl, but that's not cause to be front page headlines where millions of people are going to be threatened with cancer and leukemia. And I tell you, if you've ever sat beside a child dying of leukemia, aged 4, belly swollen as the liver and spleen are enlarged, pallid, sickly, grey-yellow skin, bald from the chemotherapy, bleeding, oozing blood from its nose and its mouth and its vagina and its rectum, dying, then you know what I'm talking about. That should be front page headlines.
You've recently established the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, NPRI. Among its goals is to inform the U.S. public, its policymakers, and the global community. You talk about NPRI will provide important and now missing commentary on the risks of nuclear policies. What's that all about, and how are you going to achieve that?
Yes, well, when I wrote the book, The New Nuclear Danger, and I wrote about the Heritage Foundation and how pervasive it is and how really wicked it is and what it's doing, I thought, my God, we've got to counter it. So the thought was just a natural progression. Okay, I'm going to set up an institute equal and opposite to the Heritage Foundation and take them on full frontal in the media. We've got the best experts in every single area, Yucca Mountain, Mobile Chernobyl bill, the nuclear power plants and how they're not being protected against terrorists, what happens if there's a nuclear meltdown, the doctors who'll come on and talked about the medical effects of a meltdown, why are people being given potassium iodide tablets that live near nuclear reactors, what are the five layers of Star Wars, what is theater missile defense, what's the boost phase, what's the transit phase, what are they going to do to militarize space, what's Lawrence Livermore doing with its national ignition facility to the tune of millions of dollars, designing a pure fusion weapon which is unverifiable from space. Who's involved in this? Which corporations? Which scientists? Which politicians? We're going to dissect out, as you do a human body when you study anatomy, we're going to dissect out every single issue in the nuclear area and put the world's experts on the media to debate the Heritage Foundation, to debate Frank Gaffney, who comes from the Center for Security Policy, on whose board sits Edward Teller and Lockheed Martin. It's not a grassroots movement. It's going to be a treetops organization. We will have a couple of research fellows researching various aspects of the nuclear issue. For instance, what will laser weapons in space do to the Earth's atmosphere? In the light of global warming, is the data new now on nuclear winter, when we thought 1,000 bombs could end life on Earth? Is it fewer now or more? We need to have symposia on that in major universities. We will hold special briefing sessions for the major reporters in the American media. We will hold special breakfasts for the senators in Washington to teach them about the medical consequences of Star Wars and the like. So basically, it will be staffed by extremely efficient, credible people. Not a lot, but we will have a huge influence. It's pretty easy to mobilize Americans who are good, kind, caring, loving people who desperately want to do the right thing and who just need to be updated now about the nuclear threat.
How can people learn more about the Nuclear Policy Research Institute?
They can go to the website, nuclearpolicy.org, and learn about it from there. But I certainly advise them to read the book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military Industrial Complex, which is the primer. We now are really all the physicians to a planet which is in the intensive care unit. And as I had to read and learn every word of Grey's Anatomy, this is the new Grey's Anatomy for the planet. So I invite you to read that, go to the website, and you can certainly contact us through our email, and we'd be thrilled to hear from you and thrilled to receive your support financially.
We call our program Clear and Present Danger. What is the clear and present danger to freedom of expression and the public's right to know today?
The corporate control of America. And now you see the rotten side of it, and you get rid of the corporations out of politics, and you take over your media paid for by your tax dollars and the federal government, like we do with the BBC and the ABC in Australia, and it has an independent charter, and you at last have freedom of speech on your media. So you're not all brainwashed by the corporations who have a bottom line only. That's money.
Dr. Caldicott, it's been a thrill to be with you. I thank you so much.
Thank you.
Renowned writer, pediatrician, and activist Dr. Helen Caldicott speaking with Stephen Rohde at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. This was part two of a 10-part series, A Clear and Present Danger, a production of PEN USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. It was produced by Deborah Jones and Ellen Moskowitz and engineered by Mark Torres. To find out more about PEN USA, go to www.penusa.org. Well, as we celebrate Mother's Day this weekend, Nancy Olson, former host of the radio program Mambo, a mom's show with attitude, reminds us of the history behind the holiday.
The roots of Mother's Day are a far cry from the splashy cell phone ads and the relentless reminders to buy flowers that we know now. In 1870, it was Julia Ward Howe, mom of six kids, who wrote the Mother's Day Proclamation for Peace. She had recently walked the battlefields of the Civil War with her husband and with Abraham Lincoln. She had just written the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But now, as the Franco-Prussian War was beginning, she felt that she could not bear any more violence. She called for a Congress of Women to gather immediately to promote peace. A Mother's Day for Peace. Listen to her speech. Arise, then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts, whether your baptism be that of water or of tears. Say firmly, we will not have questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm. Disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them then solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, each bearing after their own time the sacred impress not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and of humanity, I earnestly ask that a general council of women, without limit of nationality, may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient and at the earliest period consistent with its objects, to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interests of peace. Julia Ward Howe held a standing room only meeting in Boston the day that she read that proclamation. But a Mother's Day for Peace did not become an annual event nationwide. About this same time, there was Anna Jarvis, who organized a Mother's Friendship Day, in which mothers from both North and South whose sons had died in the Civil War came, dressed in gray or blue, to commemorate North or South, to hold hands together and sing. That Anna Jarvis had a daughter, also named Anna Jarvis. On May 10, 1908, young Anna Jarvis organized what is now considered to be the first Mother's Day, a church service dedicated to mothers, recognizing the unappreciated work that mothers do and calling for peace in the home and in the world. Andrews Methodist Church in Grafton, West Virginia, is considered the mother church of Mother's Day. The next year, Mother's Day was celebrated in 45 states. On May 9, 1914, President Woodrow Wilson officially named the second Sunday in May Mother's Day. That declaration included flowering language about the important role mothers play in the home and in society. But there was no mention in this document of a mother's role in promoting peace in the world. The holiday took hold and gained momentum as a time of giving flowers, gifts, and cards to our mothers. I'm the mom of three kids, ages 8, 9, and 12. I'll get the flowers and the cards. I'm even hoping for a nice brunch. I love being appreciated for being a mom. I always let my own mom know how much I love her on the big day. And who doesn't love a bouquet of flowers in May? But there's so much more at stake. This year I've been telling my kids about Julia Ward Howe and Anna Jarvis. The tears burn in my eyes as I speak the words of Julia Ward Howe, written in 1870, but alarmingly relevant today. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, "Disarm, disarm." Happy Mother's Day.
Nancy Olson is the former host of the radio program Mambo, a mom's show with attitude. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor today was Laurel Paget-Seekins. Our engineer today was T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. And our associate producer is Angelique Sofar. We have production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA, Adam Campy and Keith Xiaojian. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening. Have a happy Mother's Day.